a whole bunch of years ago, I had the most incredible opportunity to go to Israel. And it was, there were lots of things about that trip that were really amazing, some that were funny, some that were weird. But one of the parts of the trip that really stuck out to me was when we were down in the southern parts of Israel by the Dead Sea. And all around the Dead Sea is desert. And it's beautiful desert, but it's desert. And there are hills and caves all over the place and things like that. And I had this moment where I was standing there and I was looking at the vastness of it all around me. And I was really struck by all the stories in the Old Testament about David before he became King David. And he was anointed. He was going to be king one day, but he wasn't there yet. And the current king also knew that. And so had decided he was going to kill off David so he couldn't get in the way. And so there's this whole chunk of time in Israel's history when David was hiding in the hills all around the Dead Sea, the caves and the desert all over there. And as I was standing there, I was struck by the fact that even having grown up hearing stories of David when I went to Sunday school and things like that, and so I believe David was a real person. When I was standing there in the place where David used to hide in all of the caves, somehow he became so much more real. He wasn't just a character in children's stories. He wasn't just this person out of legend, but I could almost picture him in those caves, the soldiers hiding and the soldiers charging and trying to find him and cut him down. There was something about being in the place that turned him from a character in a story to somebody who was real to me. Now, when we talk about Jesus, there's a lot of talk out there in the world around us asking the question of whether or not Jesus was a real person. There's a number of people who will say, you know what, I don't think that Jesus actually really existed at all. I don't think he was a real guy. Maybe he was a real guy, but not all the things that Christianity makes him out to be and all of that. And so I want to start by saying, by drawing your attention to a couple historians who wrote about Jesus. And these are not historians like who work at the U of T today. These are historians who lived in the first century of, well, the first century in the Roman Empire. The first one is, his name is Tacitus. And he was born about 20 years after Jesus died. So the middle of the first century he was born. He was a Roman senator, which meant he had some power, some prestige, some position in the world. He was not a Christian. He's said to have pretty much despised Christians of the day. He was a highly regarded Roman historian. And across the board, people still respect him as being a really great historian in the first century. Near the end of his life, he published something called the Annals. And in this publication, this history that he published, he included a biography of one of the emperors whose name was Nero. Now, Nero was one of Rome's most notorious, infamous maybe, emperors of the first century. One of the things that happened was in 64 AD, 64 of the first century, Rome, the city, almost completely burned to the ground. 70% of the city was completely destroyed by a fire. And the rumor was that Nero had started the fire, that Nero had burnt down his own city. He had some building plans, some building projects he wanted to do, and so he figured if he could just burn away all the slums and all the houses that were in the way of what he wanted to build, that would be great. Now, there's no proof that Nero started the fire, but that was the rumor. And so Nero himself was constantly trying to counteract that rumor and say, no, it wasn't me, it wasn't me. Look at me, I'm a really good guy. And then he said, oh, you know who it was? It was the Christians. They did it. Now, why on earth anybody would think the Christians, who at the time were still very new, they were still mostly meeting and hiding, they were like it was just a weird group for him to blame. But he needed somebody, and they were a great scapegoat. And so when Tacitus, the historian, was writing about this stage in Rome's history, this is what he wrote. Neither human effort nor the emperor's generosity nor the placating of the gods ended the scandalous belief that the fire had been ordered by Nero. Therefore, to put down the rumor, Nero substituted as culprits and punished in the most unusual ways those hated for their shameful acts, whom the crowd called Christians. The founder of this name, Christ, Christus in Latin, had been executed in the reign of Tiberius by the procurator Pontius Pilate. Now, he's not talking about Jesus in here, like that's not the point of what he's writing, but he mentions him just in passing. Hey, this guy who was crucified, who was executed at this time, in the time of this emperor, was a real person. And this is this little snippet which says, there was really a guy named Jesus who was known as the Christ, who people followed and who started this thing called Christianity. There was another historian, and his name was Josephus, and he was a Jewish historian who really, really kind of loved Rome, especially by the end of his life. He was living in Rome. And he was born even earlier than Tacitus. He was born less than 10 years probably after Jesus was killed. He was a Jewish historian. He was part of a priestly Jewish family. He was kind of an aristocrat on both his father's and mother's sides. Eventually, he did move to Rome. He was considered a traitor by many Jews. He wasn't a Christian at all. He wrote a 20-volume history of Jews and Judaism that spanned all the way from creation through to mid-60s AD. So that's a long period of time. Now, you could try and read his stuff. He's not a great writer. It's 20 volumes. It's long what he had to write. But he's one of our best sources of history and of the world at that time, and especially of that part of the world at that time. And in his writing, there's a point in the last book in his writing where he actually mentions James, the brother of Jesus, who is called the Christ, is how he talks about James. James was a common name, so he had to give an identifier, the brother of Jesus. Jesus was kind of a common name, so he had to give that a qualifier, who is called the Christ. It was just in passing. He wasn't talking specifically about James. He was making a different point. But all of a sudden, here comes Jesus again showing up in a history. In an earlier volume, he also wrote something. Now, this one is a little bit more contested. Did he really write it? Did he not? The part that I'm going to read is largely accepted as being, yep, this is true, what Josephus wrote. He wrote, around this time there lived Jesus, a wise man, for he was one who did surprising deeds and a teacher of such people as accept the truth gladly. He won over many Jews and many Greeks. When Pilate, upon hearing him accused by men of the highest standing among us, had condemned him to be crucified, those who in the first place came to love him did not give up their affection for him. And the tribe of Christians, so called, came after him, have still to this day not died out. And so here we have a couple of first century historians who bring up Jesus in just kind of a passing way. That's not like the New Testament, which is all about Jesus. They just bring it up in a passing way, suggesting that, no, you know what? Jesus, who we read about in the Gospels, who Paul writes and others write about in the New Testament, was actually a real historical figure. They agree that he was a Jewish man named Jesus who lived early in the first century. They agree that this man did surprising things, that he had disciples or followers, that he was arrested, that he was put to death by Pontius Pilate, who was the Roman governor over Judea at the time. All of that is pretty much agreed upon. But none of that tells us why we're here this morning, 2,000 years later. Because none of that really answers the question, who is he? Who is Jesus really, beyond those simple facts of his life and his death? This passage in Matthew 13 is set happening in the area of Caesarea Philippi. And in that area of the Middle East at the time, it was a city that was filled to the brim with all sorts of temples, all sorts of places of worship to various Greek and Roman gods. The big one for that city was the god Pan, who was a Greek god named Pan. The city used to be called Panias or Panias after that god. So that's how big that god was. And so Jesus is having this conversation within the context of being surrounded by representations of so many other gods, so many other religions grabbing for people's attention. And he says in the midst of that to his disciples, who do people say that the Son of Man is? Now, when he says the Son of Man, he's referring to himself. And that is, most simply, Son of Man just means a human being, somebody who was born of a person. Contrast it to Son of God, somebody who was born of God. And so he refers to himself as a Son of Man. But there's also, for anybody who was familiar with the Hebrew scriptures at the time, which the disciples definitely would have been, the Son of Man is a title. It comes out of one of the prophetic books in the Old Testament, the Daniel chapter 7. In Daniel 7, we read this: "As I watched in the night visions," Daniel was having this great vision, "I saw one like a human being, Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven, and he came to the Ancient One, God, and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and kingship, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that shall not pass away, and his kingship is one that shall never be destroyed." That is who Jesus knew. Anybody familiar with the Hebrew scriptures would also come to mind when he used that title for himself, the Son of Man. And so he says to his disciples, "Who do people out there say the Son of Man is?" Some say John the Baptist, Elijah, Jeremiah, all of whom were prophets, John the Baptist being the most recent, prophets who did miracles, prophets who stood toe-to-toe with kings and challenged them and convicted them and called them to account, prophets who spoke on God's behalf to the nation of Israel, prophets whose words had been passed down through the centuries as being from God. So that's pretty good. "Hey, Jesus, we think you're the reincarnation of one of these great guys, because clearly you're also a really great guy." And Jesus says to them, though, he looks at them and he says, "But okay, who do you say that I am?" I wonder if they were silent for a minute. I can almost picture them looking at each other and going, "Oh no, this is a trick. He's going to trick us with something. He's got an answer in mind. Do we know it? Who wants to answer for us?" And Peter, because he's Peter, he decides, "I'll answer." And he says, usually he says very foolish things, not this time. Peter says, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." The Messiah is more than a prophet, has similarities with the prophets, but is more than a prophet. And Jesus says to Simon, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah," we call him Peter, "for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven." You are blessed because God has revealed to you who I am. Simon didn't know this because he was listening really closely and he was comparing the things Jesus did to the things the prophets had said he would do. He wasn't sitting there going, "Oh, you know, well, I've seen this and this happen and I've put together this piece and so therefore logic dictates that this must be who you are." That wasn't, Peter didn't have any of those skills. That wasn't at all what was happening. Something had been revealed to him by God himself about the identity of who Jesus was. See, this is the problem we face when we get caught up in trying to prove Jesus. It's one thing when we go, "Oh, you know what? We got to prove that Jesus actually existed, was a real person." But that's not the whole story. That's almost a, "So what? Jesus was real. So was a guy named Fred somewhere." So, right? Like that's just a person. The point that we need to figure out is, how do we know that Jesus was the Son of Man, referred to in Daniel 7, the one given authority by God himself, the one who would be called the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, the one who would reign over the kingdom of heaven? How do we know that's who it is? And Peter didn't know because he put pieces together and it made logical, scientific sense. He knew because he had something revealed to him that was truth, that was revealed to him by God. See, knowing who Jesus is requires us to actually know Jesus. Maybe it begins with us believing what other people tell us about Jesus. Maybe it begins with people saying, "Oh, you know what? Jesus loves you. Jesus is this guy who lived. Let's read the stories in the New Testament. This is who Jesus was," and maybe we believe that. But there's a difference between believing who Jesus is because people tell us and knowing deep in our souls who Jesus is, knowing that he is the Son of Man, the King of Kings, the Son of God himself. To know anybody requires that we be in relationship with them, doesn't it? See, people might tell me, any one of you, that person's really smart. They're really trustworthy. They're a really good person. And I might believe them if I think that they are trustworthy, or I might not if I don't know. But I don't know for sure that you're actually trustworthy, or that you're actually a good person, or that you're actually very smart, because I don't know you. I don't know anything about you. I'm just going on what somebody else has said. I'm believing it. But if I get to know you, if I spend time with you, we sit over coffee, we have conversations, we read books together, we go for walks together, whatever it is, we get to know each other. And then we know, oh, I know this person is smart, trustworthy, a good person, any number of things. Now, the other thing we need to understand about Peter's confession, we call it his confession, his acknowledgement of Jesus as the Son of Man, is that he didn't actually yet fully understand what all of that meant. He didn't fully yet understand who Jesus was. Just think about this. When Jesus was having this conversation, this is before he'd been crucified and then resurrected. This was in the middle of the story. There's no possible way that anybody could have known the totality of what this was all about. This is because there needs to be ongoing relationship. Peter knew something, knew a piece of it there, but the more he got to know Jesus, the more he knew Jesus. And it went on as he witnessed Jesus' crucifixion, and he suffered the horrible guilt because he denied even knowing Jesus when that was going on. And when he experienced Jesus and he met Jesus after Jesus had been resurrected from the dead, and when Jesus asked him three times while he was resurrected, "Do you love me?" And he gave him a commission to go feed his sheep. And then when Peter went all over the place and he shared about Jesus and he told people what had happened, he grew constantly in his knowledge, in his relationship with Jesus. And so who he would describe Jesus to be would be different the longer he was in relationship with him, because he got to know him more and more and more intimately. See, the thing that is with us is that we can know all about Jesus and think, "That's lovely," right? Or maybe we don't think it's lovely. Maybe we think it's all ridiculous. Maybe we think, "Oh, why do people give up Sunday mornings when it's a perfectly good time to sleep? Why would they on earth go to church, right? Why would they want to spend time talking about Jesus or singing about Jesus or hearing about Jesus? What is all this about?" And let's not get on the fact that Jesus is the thing that gets in the way when we try and have great conversations between the major world religions. Because often we say, "You know what? We have lots of similarities in the gods, but Jesus is the stumbling block. Jesus is the one who only belongs to Christianity. So what do we do with that?" If all we're doing is saying, "I believe this guy existed," kind of okay, but that's just a place to start. Jesus is alive and wants to be in relationship with us, wants to be known by us. And as we know Jesus, as we get to know Jesus, we know more and more about him. We aren't just reading that Jesus is good. We aren't just reading that Jesus is trustworthy. We aren't just reading that Jesus loves us, but we know it deep in ourselves because we get to know him. Jesus said to Peter, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it." Now, these verses, this verse and the ones that follow, they've caused a lot of trouble in the Christian world over the last 2,000 years. So first off, there's a play on words that happens in the Greek. Peter, the Greek word is petros. Rock is petra. So there's a play on words. You are petros, and on this petra, I will build my church. Petros, which we understand to be Peter, which is always translated as Peter, we call him Peter from this point on, wasn't actually a personal name at the time. It meant a little round stone. You are a little round stone, and on this rock, I will build my church. We ask the question, what does this mean when he says, "On this rock, I will build my church"? Is he talking about, "I'll build my church on you, Peter"? Or is he talking about what Peter just said about who Jesus is? This confession that Jesus is the Son of Man, the Messiah, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, all that's wrapped up in that title. I'm convinced, and there's others who would disagree with me, but I am convinced that Jesus is here referring to Peter's answer, not to Peter himself. And I'm convinced for two reasons. Petros is a little round stone. You don't build anything on a little round stone. First off, it's round, it'll fall off. And second off, it's little, it can't hold anything. And second, if you like grammar, the word that's used for rock and the word that's used for church are both feminine grammatically, and so there's a grammatical connection between those. I can point you to things to look up if you're interested in finding more about those. But I think that what Jesus was saying was, you are this little round stone. You are part of this thing that I am building. You are part of this great rock, this foundation. But the rock itself is that I am the Son of Man. And everything that comes around that. The church will be built on the Son of Man himself. And not even the gates of Hades itself, of hell itself, of the place of death itself, is going to be able to prevail against this church. Nothing can, because the rock is that solid. I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock, on your confession that I am the Messiah, the Son of the living God, not just the Son of Man, I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. And I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. This one has had problems, people understanding it for forever. It sounds, on first listen, it sounds maybe like Peter, or like the church, gets to dictate to God that heaven has to abide by whatever we say. So if we say something is loosed, God has to make it loosed. If we say something is bound, God has to make it bound. There was a movie released years and years ago, totally irreverent movie called Dogma, and it was based around the whole concept of there being loopholes, and one of the loopholes being, God has to do what we've said, because whatever you bind on earth is bound in heaven, whatever you loose on earth is loosed in heaven. But that's a problem, obviously, because it turns Peter, it turns the church into God, and we know, if we're even a tiny bit honest, we know that the church is not God. We know the church should not be God. What we do know, well, what I think that we can be confident in is this, that when we talk about binding something, we're talking about putting a boundary around it. We're talking about containing it. When we're talking about loosing something, we're talking about removing those boundaries. We're talking about setting it free. We know that the kingdom of heaven has come and is coming to earth in Jesus. Jesus said at the very beginning, he said, my ministry is going to be proclaiming the kingdom of God has come. Repent, for the kingdom of heaven has come. We know that the kingdom of heaven is the presence of Jesus, is the reign of God on earth as it is in heaven. We know that to be given the keys to this kingdom is to be given the power to create or remove barriers into the kingdom. Now, this isn't about rules of entry. God's not saying, okay, church, you come up with the rules. Who gets to come in? Who has to stay out? You come up with the rules, and I'll just go with it. That is not the way that God works. That's not what this is saying here at all. It can't be what this is saying here at all, because it's contrary to who God is. The kingdom is open to anyone who wants to enter, because relationship with Jesus is open to anyone who wants to be in relationship. There are no prerequisites. There are no requirements. There's no test. You just have to say, Jesus, I want to be in relationship with you. I want to know you. And okay, it's done. There you go. But by our words and actions, this is something else we know. By our words and actions, we can actually help, or we can hinder people from experiencing that relationship. How many of us have experienced the ugliness of Christians at times? Maybe we just see it on the news or things like that. People do things in the name of God that are horrendous, don't they? How many people does that keep from the kingdom of heaven? How many people look at that and go, well, if that's who Jesus Christ is, if that's what the kingdom of heaven is, if that's what Christianity is, I don't want any part of it. I am a Christian. And there have been times I've looked at what's going on in the world in the name of Christ, and I thought, man, I'm not sure I want any part of this. We also have the power in our words and in our actions to help people experience the kingdom. Every time we offer grace, every time we take time with somebody, we truly listen, every time we forgive, every time we feed the hungry or clothe the naked or visit those who are imprisoned, all the things that Jesus did and Jesus said, every time we do that, we are helping make the kingdom of heaven more accessible. We're helping make Jesus more accessible. How are you hindering people having a relationship with Jesus? How are you helping people have a relationship with Jesus? But the thing is, before we can bind or loose, before we hinder or help, before we talk anything about the kingdom of heaven at all, it starts with knowing Jesus. We have to answer the question for ourselves, who do you say that Jesus is? Who do I say that Jesus is? Maybe this is a new question for you. Maybe you don't have a clue. That's okay. Maybe you used to know, you're not sure anymore. Maybe it's different now than it was before. That's okay. But maybe spend some time this week with that question. Who do I say that Jesus is?